are ignorant about what's the stance of these parties in regards to the human rights issues.
A United Nations official wants to know if ongoing talks with North Korea include issues related to human rights. This is Thursday, the 25th of October, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You have a chance to talk to us about our program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, as the Japanese leader readies his trip to China, we see how the longtime foes might find ways to work together. You'll hear how some U.S. farmers are looking at the U.S.-China trade war, and where does this trade war lead? It's all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. rapporteur on North Korea, Argentine rights lawyer Tomas Ojea Quintana, has expressed concern about the lack of any reference on human rights in declarations and other statements coming out of this year's security thaw involving the Koreas and the U.S.
We don't know even if the human rights issues were discussed during those meetings. We are ignorant about what's the stance of these parties in regards to the human rights issues. And this is something that needs to be raised here, especially in New York, where the General Assembly sits and the Security Council sits. And I am committed as the UN mandate holder appointed by the Human Rights Council to raise my voice, to offer my assistance to the parties in regards to how to address the human rights situation in North Korea, bearing in mind that not so long ago, where the well-known Commission of Inquiry issued its report with very serious findings about systematic, widespread human rights abuses in North Korea, even referring to the possibility of crimes against humanity being committed in the country.
Quintana said the rights situation in North Korea has not changed, and it is time for Pyongyang to show commitment to the rights agenda by ending its isolation and allowing access to outside investigators. He likened it to his warnings about crimes against humanity while serving as a UN investigator in Myanmar. Now, he added, we see the consequences, a reference to last year's security crackdown against the Rohingya Muslims. Greg Scarlatu, executive director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, told VOA's Victor Beatty he agrees with Quintana's assessment that nothing has changed.
The political prison camps, the Kwaliso camps, and the re-education through labor camps, the Kyohwaso detention facilities, are still there. This is where tens of thousands of North Korean men, women, and children are incarcerated without adequate food or medical care. They're regularly abused. They're subjected to a relentless, vicious cycle of forced labor and induced malnutrition. I agree with the special rapporteur. And by the way, the special rapporteur, as far as I know, is a big supporter of engagement, peace process. And at the same time, he has made it very clear that human rights must be on the agenda. Human rights must be part of these talks.
Greg, has human rights come up at all in all of these meetings and summits between U.S. and Korean leaders?
Certainly, human rights did not come out in official statements. This comes as no surprise to us, North Korean human rights defenders. Over the past three decades, human rights has often been outcompeted by very serious concerns over North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. Nevertheless, since February 2014, since the report of the UN Commission of Inquiry, human rights has been, for most of the time, at the top of the agenda. We issued a press release urging the North Korean Human Rights Resolution, which is to be passed in the third committee of the UN General Assembly, should be a strong one on par with previous resolutions, in particular with General Assembly resolutions passed every fall since 2014. We have made the point that we must continue to remember that widespread and systematic crimes against humanity identified by the UN Commission of Inquiry must be referenced in this year's General Assembly resolution again. Of course, mention of the camps of North Korea's vast system of unlawful imprisonment. It is also very important that accountability should be mentioned and included in the resolution. Another point that we have made is that the rights of workers are violated inside North Korea, at North Korea's prison facilities, and also overseas, where those 100,000 North Korean workers officially dispatched to 30 countries work.
North Korea's UN mission says the resolution would politicize the rights issue.
The North Koreans have continued to make this argument. It makes no sense. We have a 372-page report by the UN Commission of Inquiry, thoroughly researched by most eminent former commissioners who worked on this report. It is UN agencies, it is also civil society organizations such as HRNK that have collected very thoroughly information on North Korea's human rights situation. We have interviewed countless North Korean escapees. We have gone through a very large number of satellite images. We have analyzed those satellite images. The evidence is there. The only government on the face of the planet that is still denying the existence of these unlawful detention facilities is the DPRK government.
Greg Scarlatus said the ultimate measure of reconciliation and peace on the Korean Peninsula will be the impact it has on the Korean people, and that will be impossible if human rights are eliminated from the equation. VOA Asia continues. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe embarks on a three-day trip to China Thursday, the first in 7 years by a Japanese leader, with a vow of improving cooperation and friendship in a relationship with a bitter past. During a key policy speech Wednesday before the Japanese parliament, Mr. Abe said the effort to engage will involve people-to-people exchanges, deeper business ties, and sports cooperation. The visit comes as the two countries mark the 40th anniversary of the Treaty of Japan-China Peace and Friendship. It follows a visit to Japan in May by Chinese Premier Li Keqiang. Stephen Nagy is a senior associate professor in politics and international studies at the International Christian University in Tokyo. He's written that both Chinese President Xi Jinping and Mr. Abe have consolidated their domestic political power and, despite security differences, believe their countries can benefit from closer ties.
For the Japanese, I think they do have concerns about the growing trade war and technological competition between the United States and China, and what that will mean for Japanese businesses going forward. If both countries develop independent AI and digitized markets, that means the Japanese business community is going to have to bifurcate their business footprint. That's expensive, it affects supply chains, and it impacts prices. On the Chinese side, I think the rapprochement with Japan is all about economy of enemies. Over the past few years, China has put a tremendous amount of pressure on countries within the region, whether it's South Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. And, of course, its trade policies have created friction with many countries in the region and outside the region. And it has come to a realization that if it wants to concentrate and be successful moving its Sino-U.S. relations forward, that it's going to have to put out fires in the neighborhood and build bridges and build more positive, future-oriented relations within the region.
Nagy says although relations between Japan and China have been far from cordial since World War II, the two countries could form a working relationship.
The Chinese are looking for ways that they can keep the economic momentum going. Japan represents a very good partner within the region, both from the levels of technological infusion, but also Japan and Japanese firms still have an enormous amount of capital and skills that they can share with the Chinese. This is important for economic stability within the Chinese context, and it's important for development of the economy towards a less manufacturing-based economy and an economy that really focuses on technology.
Stephen Nagy said a successful summit would involve closer Sino-Japan third country infrastructure development cooperation, shelving territorial disputes, and deepening economic cooperation, for instance, on the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, free trade regime. Farmers in the American Midwest are working the fields this fall amid a trade dispute between the United States and China, once one of the largest importers of U.S. corn and soybeans. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, uncertainty looms over how it will ultimately affect farm income this year, as growers have yet to feel the full impact or benefits of the escalating trade picture.
Among the mounting concerns, Illinois farmer Bob Gerke is juggling. He is racing against the clock to harvest his corn and soybeans. Bob spends up to 14 hours a day in the fields.
biggest concern right now we're harvesting that we don't get stuck and we get the crops out before Mother Nature throws snow at us.
But his worries don't end there.
The marketer's advice, even this spring, never was calling for soybeans to go down this extreme, but they weren't thinking there was going to be a tariff.
Bob is talking about Chinese tariffs on U.S. grain products, a retaliatory move after the United States slapped tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. It's brought down soybean prices as much as $2 this year.
That's a big deal for a farmer who's counting on that yield and that farm income.
Tamara Nelson, Senior Director of Commodities for the Illinois Farm Bureau, is concerned.
This is a fifth straight year of lower farm income. I think the second lowest farm income since 2012.
Nelson says news of a pending trade agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to replace NAFTA so far isn't doing much to put farmers at ease.
Whether or not that was achieved because of the tariff threats remains to be seen, because the steel and aluminum tariffs still remain on Mexico and Canada, and their retaliatory tariffs threatened against us still remain.
Farmer Bob Gerke had hoped decades of negotiations and relationships in China would be paying off, reversing declining farm income by keeping one of the largest markets for U.S. soybeans open.
And we've built trade up to where it was working. And now within a matter of 6 months, a lot of that has been knocked down, maybe even devastated, to where will it come back? How long it's going to take to come back?
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's $12 billion aid package was supposed to be a silver lining. While it helps offset his lower soybean prices,
they're saying that we would get, I believe it's $1.60 or $1.65 a bushel.
Gerke says it doesn't help his corn.
It's a penny. Well, why even bother if you're going to give us a penny? That's more paperwork than it's worth. And then in their package, what they present, $200 million is for market development. It's like, we had the market. That's sort of a joke.
Soybeans are still being sold around the world, even if they might not be going to China. Sales to Europe and Argentina are up this year. So the question remains, are the trade tactics adopted by President Trump and his administration ultimately working?
That's probably the $64,000 question.
I think if you ask most farmers right now, they'll say no. You ask them maybe a year from now, 6 months from now, it might change their mind.
6 months from now, Gerke himself will be in a very different mindset, shifting gears from harvesting his crops to planting seeds in the ground for a new growing season, a season he hopes is filled with more certainty. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Elgin, Illinois.
As we continue on VOA Asia, we've told you earlier in the program that Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is in China this Thursday seeking better relations with China. A trade official from Indonesia says his country and China are forging closer economic ties as those two countries face threats to their trade relations with the United States. China says it has 24 FTAs, or free trade agreements, under construction, among which 16 agreements have been signed and implemented already. This seemingly is a direct reaction to the trade war between Beijing and Washington. We welcome to VOA Asia Joseph Foudy, professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at New York University. Professor, welcome. What do the Chinese want to accomplish with these agreements?
Well, they're trying to increase their leverage in any future negotiations with the United States, showing the U.S. that there are other parties that they can work with. And it's the same strategy on the other side, since at this point, you know, everybody has to worry about incurring sort of the wrath of the Trump administration.
How has this wrath, that's your explanation of it, how has this wrath and these policies that the Trump administration have taken affected, let's take as far as business is concerned, worldwide standing?
Well, it's hurt the U.S. reputation in the world, but it's important to understand at this point it's mostly rhetoric and there's been comparatively few U.S. actions. But if there's one country that seems to anticipate that there actually will be, you know, a large-scale tariffs enacted, it seems to be China.
What do you think the Trump administration's goal is here? What do they expect to accomplish?
Well, they're hoping to rewrite as many treaties as possible to sort of increase U.S. exports. From an economic perspective, that's problematic because we tend to believe that most of the U.S. trade deficit is really caused by a sort of a lack of domestic savings in the U.S. But the Trump administration believes that if it can negotiate one-on-one with most countries, it'll maximize U.S. leverage.
Does that hold any validity as far as you're concerned?
I think on the margins, you'll see the U.S. is able to extract concessions. You can look at the recent deal with Mexico and Canada. But I don't think any of these treaties will be that significant.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Have a good day.